Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is the day of the month that we talk about money management, something we've been doing for a long time on the show, always on Friday. And this time around, our guest is Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business at the U of I. He's been on the program here before, kind of as our substitute for the regular guy, Dave Sinnoh, who was taking the month off to go fishing or have vacation or do something like that.
I think David probably is fishing.
Okay. Well, we wish him good luck there, and are pleased to have Kevin here in the studio to do this usual show. And what we do here is, he may have a couple things to economic-wise to say, but the more important thing, the more useful thing we hope for you, is to give you a chance to call and say, look, here's my situation. Here's what I'm thinking about. Help me out here and as I think about what I'm going to do with my money. And this can be one piece in the puzzle for you. Of course, we want you to think very carefully, do a lot of research, get a lot of opinions. Don't just do something because either Dave or Kevin says so. But they can help you out by saying, well, okay, here's what I think. And you can take that and you go off and do your additional research. So whatever's on your mind, financial planning wise, whatever your concerns are and wherever you are in your life, if you have a question, pick up the telephone, give us a call, and I know Kevin will do his best to help you out. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you, David. And just like back in June, I'll have to apologize for this kind of weird voice I'm running, so let's call it summer allergy.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're here, and hopefully it won't be too uncomfortable for you to have to be sitting here talking for the next hour.
No uncomfort at all, as long as it's with you.
Okay. Well, is there anything in particular that you had on your mind that you'd want to talk about here at the outset?
Well, I think you did a great introduction in terms of what this show attempts to do, and I think it's a great resource that people have available to them through Will Radio. I know Dave Sinnoh usually begins his segments with kind of a review outlook and then, a kind of an overview of what to look forward to. Mm-hmm. And given that I'm a fill-in, I won't attempt to replicate that. But I would just say this. It's been an interesting summer. Many times in the summer, markets, whether they're stock markets, credit markets, whatever, tend to get a little slow, summer vacations, so on and so forth. This summer, we've certainly seen our share of excitement, whether it's commodity prices, and you want to talk about those, or the volatility in the stock market, the continuing, what I would say is evidence showing of slowing economy. It's been an exciting summer. So there certainly is a lot to talk about. Yeah.
Well, do you have some feeling for, and I'm sure that what everybody wants to, they always want to know, is they want to know what's going to happen next. We've now gotten halfway through the year, and still I think people are very concerned about where the economy is, and they're concerned about cost of living and the price of energy and the price of food and all kinds of things. Earlier in the year, we all received payment checks from the government in the hope that we would go out and spend money and that would help the economy. And everyone's watching all the various indicators, price of things, the housing market, everything very closely. And I'm sure that there were a lot of people that were hoping, that at the beginning of the year, maybe things were looking a little shaky. Then people said, well, let's see where we are halfway.
Sure.
And then maybe we can, if we're feeling optimistic, we can say maybe things will pick up a little bit in the second half of the year. So now we're halfway, a little bit past halfway.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the news that has come out over the summer has probably caused many people to postpone what was a common belief of things picking up in the second half of the year. I think there are still a number of people that are assuming that that will happen, but I think a growing number every day are now postponing perhaps until the first part of next year, any type of evidence of recovery.
Mm-hmm. Well, have we seen the worst? Maybe could you say that it's sort of leveling off so that we can expect that at least we're at the bottom and now maybe things are going to start looking up a little bit?
That's not my view. I don't think we've seen the worst of it yet.
All right. Well, we have a couple callers here, and anyone who's listening is certainly welcome to call with questions. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have someone locally here to start us off, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hi, can you discuss REITs and exchange-traded funds? Like, do they actually hold, you know, real buildings, or are they holding stocks in building companies? And like an exchange-traded note for commodities says it tracks such and such an index, but, I mean, okay, so it tracks it. What's that mean? And what are they actually holding, paper notes or actual commodities? Okay.
All right.
That's a great question. There has been, over the past couple of years, such an explosion in the number of investment vehicles, predominantly exchange-traded funds. And literally, they run the gamut from things, investment vehicles, that own the actual assets to things that I would call phantom investment vehicles. So there's no way for me to say what one does without reading the prospectus. That's something that anyone interested in an exchange-traded fund, a mutual fund, any type of investment pooling vehicle should do. Now, prospectuses are very long-winded. They're very legalese, full of huge terms. But again, even the inexperienced investor can read through the important topics and literally see what it is the fund does. So I would have to say it's a case-by-case decision. Many real estate investment trusts or REITs can be subdivided into one of two categories. They are either debt REITs or property REITs. Debt REITs hold mortgages on property. Property REITs hold actual properties. They own real estate. So that's kind of a general way to delineate real estate investment trusts. But again, the important thing is read the document that underlies the vehicle before you just make an assumption.
Yeah. Just you don't have to think too long before you start thinking that maybe if you were interested in investing in real estate, you'd want to have the asset and not the debt. If at least now, recently, we've seen a lot of trouble with investment instruments that essentially were bundles of mortgages. Mm-hmm. And the ones that really got into trouble were the ones that were bundles of subprime loans.
Right.
And so that would make me think, I think that would make me think twice about investing in a REIT that was a debt REIT and not, at least I'd figure, well, you know, an asset's an asset that it can lose value, but I'd rather actually have the thing that has the value.
Exactly. But even with something more conservative, perhaps in general description, a property REIT, some property REITs can be levered so they can borrow money to buy property, to buy mm-hmm. real estate, as opposed to an unlevered property REIT. The other consideration, too, is this. A real estate investment trust is literally a conduit investment. It's a pass-through. By law, they have to distribute at least 90% of their gains and income. Why do you own property, whether individually or through a real estate investment trust? And the answer is, aside from your personal residence, to create income. These REITs, even if they're unlevered, still have tremendous risk based on occupancy. If the economy slows, if the rental rates are so high that occupancies drop and we have more vacancies, the income stream suffers, and so does the value of the property.
Hmm. Most REITs, are they commercial property, or are there some that are all blends or I suppose it could be apartment buildings or something like that?
Yeah, the vast majority of them you and I would term as commercial property. Mm-hmm. They might be subdivided into things like apartments. They might be subdivided into things like shopping centers. They might be even subdivided into real estate development trusts where tracts of land get turned into eventual subdivisions. So there are different shades of the colors.
All right. Next, we'll talk with someone in Bloomington, Indiana, on our line four, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Kevin, I have heard financial experts say that we are now in a bear market, a bear stock market. would you, and they also say that you can tell we're in a bear market. One of the reasons they say you can tell we're in a bear market is because the market is volatile. Would you define what a bear market is, and why would a bear market be more volatile than a bull market? And I'll take my question off the air.
Well, thank you. That's a good question. The I would say traditional definition of a bear market is a 20% or more decline in an index that you're using to track the market. So I'll give you, for instance, October 9th this past year, the Dow Industrial Average peaked at 14,164. If you looked at that, how should we say, best point, and took it to July 15th this year when the Dow was at its low so far, that was roughly a 24% decline. So there's where many people are calling a bear market. When the Dow in early June tempted with that 20% loss from its peak, people started using the terminology bear market. Now, why volatility might be higher at a bear market than during a bull market, I don't necessarily believe that it is. If we were to go back to this past fall, common measures of volatility, the VIX index is the most popular one that you hear discussed. It's basically a measure based on stock options. The VIX index was much more indicating higher volatility then than now.
Okay. Again, hope that gets at the question of the caller. We are here this morning doing Money Talk. This is the day that we've set aside to talk about personal finance. And if we can help you out, I know Kevin, our guest, Kevin Wasby, will do his best. You have a question about investing or money management, give us the call. 333-9455, toll free. 800-222-9455. Kevin is a lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business at the U of I, sitting in this time around for Dave Sino. Next, we'll talk with somebody in Montgomery on a cell phone, line number two. Hello.
Hey, good morning. I was just wondering, I'm in construction, and I've been in this business for 26 years. I've never seen it this bad. In fact, I'm getting out of it. I had a degree in forestry, and the Forest Service years ago in the 70s, when I started working full time, then my job got axed then. So my question would be, okay, now where do you turn since we're losing all these jobs? Everybody seems to be going, you know, across the Atlantic or the Pacific to invest in other things cheaper, might I add, than Americans. It's kind of frustrating because I have a house. And I'm getting close to paying it off, but I'm not making any money. I'm going bankrupt because of all the taxes I have to pay, and everything's just hitting me all at once. So my question to you would be, what do you do? I mean, the average citizen can't put money away anymore. It's ridiculous.
Well, I think some of the things that you've discussed are characteristic of our economy, and it's more so characteristic than just right now. I mean, literally, if we went back 30 years, we've seen a tremendous evolution in our economy, and it's been an evolution away from what I would call a manufacturing-based economy, more into a service-based economy. We saw back in the 1970s and early 80s a similar circumstance as we're seeing again today in Detroit. U.S. Steel, Bethlehem Steel, you know, all on the verge of bankruptcy. The car companies in the same way. And now it seems, with the exception of the steel companies, which are still doing great, the car companies are again on the doorstep of bankruptcy. What I think we're seeing is not so much a displacement of jobs overseas, but characteristic of a long-term evolutionary trend in our economy. If you, for example, were to talk to a construction worker in Houston, my guess is they're probably going to say just the opposite as what you said. Because guess what? Energy is again booming. I know that operators of rigs cannot find qualified workers fast enough to staff those drilling rigs. So what's my answer to you? Answer number one, first thing we need to do is sit down and have a beer. When we do that, we collect our thoughts and we try to map out a long-term strategy. And like anything else with a career decision, you have to decide, what are you in it for? Construction work has always been seasonal work in this geographic area. I know. I used to work roads and bridges, so I've picked up a shovel and shoveled enough concrete, I know. The bottom line is this. It's always been a seasonal business, and it's always been a feast or famine business. If you don't like risk of the famine side of it, then you have to find something that's a little smoother. One of the things I think you might investigate is looking at those industries that support what will probably be a long-term need. If you figure that we're going to need energy, then maybe it makes sense to think about working in an area where energy construction is probably going to be in demand for some time to come.
Again, I hope that helps the caller. Just real quick, and I know I got some other people. I hope you won't mind if I go on. The housing values in housing, have we seen the bottom yet, or is it continue to go down? No, we have not seen the bottom yet.
We are so overhoused and overlevered that in getting to this situation, literally over the past 25 years, we're not going to unwind this in a single year.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, last caller. Let's talk next with someone in Fithian. This is line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm a teacher, and the 403B plan, I had my money with Vanguard, but apparently you need to have third-party administrators now, and they're switching to somebody who's coming in and saying we have to choose between security benefits and Equitable. Equitable has only variable annuities. So if you could, please explain what those are and if they should be in my 403B. Security benefits, if you can explain what that is, but it sounds like they have a bunch of companies like Dreyfus in it. And he said the cheapest cost is like 2.2%. You know, with Vanguard, they have very low costs. And I don't know if I should... I don't know how to do the math to figure out, you know, if you take a 2.2% hit right at the start of, with your money, which you're not going to have that to compound over time, maybe I should be looking at just paying taxes and then buying the Roth IRA. So I'm going to hang up and listen, but it's kind of, if you just give me a general idea. Thank you.
Okay.
Sure. Very good question. I was visiting with a friend of mine yesterday who was helping his daughter, who just got her first full-time job out of college. She works for a not-for-profit. They also have a 403B arrangement like a teacher would have. And here's the not-so-kind statement I used with him when I was talking about it. I said, most 403B plans are set up to put the expense of them on the shoulders of the participants. And what that means is this. The administrative work in complicated government-qualified retirement plans, like 401Ks for the private sector, like 403Bs for the public sector or not-for-profits, have a lot of expenses associated with them. More often than not, those expenses are borne by the participants, meaning your investment elections are constricted to very high-cost investment selections. Now, that's, you know, again, not a very kind thing to say to the sponsor of those plans, but it's more often true than not. Bottom line is this. If you look at those two choices you have, you're basically locked into either an insurance company's variable annuity plans, which are basically mutual funds within a life insurance product. It's sort of like belt and suspenders. As a retirement plan goes, I'm not a big fan of variable annuities within the retirement plan itself. The variable annuity can be used for other better purposes outside of a retirement plan, in my opinion. So that kind of forces me or directs me toward things like mutual funds. So the other investment how should we say, third-party administrator, offers you a group of mutual funds. And those funds should be what I would say low-cost, low-overhead funds. But again, the administrator of the plan doesn't want to pay for those, for the administration of the plan. So the funds that you're stuck with are very high expense funds. Now, saying all of that, if you look at those investment opportunities, I think one thing that you'll find is the 2% is what might be referred to as an expense ratio, as opposed to a front-end load. The mention you made about not having all of your money being able to work for you, that applies to a load or commission paid up front at time of purchase. And I agree wholeheartedly, you definitely don't want to go in any of that direction. The expense ratio, on the other hand, is basically a burden you, the participant in the mutual fund, bear as it relates to the investment performance of the fund. It's the expense ratio. The fund manager is paying management fees to himself, administrative fees to the fund sponsor, all those good things that come out of that 2%. And the math is real simple. Think of it this way. Whatever the investment portfolio does as an investment rate of return for the year, subtract that overhead or expense ratio from it, 2%, and that's your rate of return as a participant in that fund. So they have to make 2% for you to break even. Now, excuse me, all of that said and done, if you look at the investment opportunities within those mutual funds, look for index funds because they're going to be the cheapest of any of them, and hope to find one that has less than 1%. It'll probably be better to go that route than to say, well, I'm just not going to use the 403B. You did bring up a very interesting alternative, though, and that is the Roth IRA and some of the plans or some of the tax laws that have been changing, depending on your age, depending on past contributions to plans, and something that you might want to talk with a person about your specifics that might actually make a Roth alternative something more appropriate for you given those high expenses in the 403B.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But that's going to be a very individual type of circumstance. Again, collect your papers, visit with somebody knowledgeable in the field, and have them make a determination based on your individual circumstance.
So just as a general principle, if you're choosing between funds and you may have the opportunity to invest in a number of funds that have no upfront loads, so that's all equal there, then one of the next things you're going to look at is what is the expense ratio.
Exactly, expense ratio.
And I suppose one of the advantages of at least some of the 403Bs is that they waive the usual requirements. And it seems to me, from having just recently looked at some of these things, is the ones that have the lowest expense ratios are also the ones that require the biggest initial investment. But with the 403B, they waive that. So at least was my understanding is that, you know, some of these funds that ordinarily, if you were just a regular guy off the street, you would have to have a lot of money. Now you can put in smaller amounts and you can take advantage of those that have the much smaller expense ratio.
Right. And that's another part of what I meant about the individual circumstance of the caller. If a person looking through the prospectus and the actual summary plan description for the 403B spots that and says, well, gee, you have access with a first dollar contribution to a fund that only has a 30 basis point expense ratio, then, again, we're looking at a different suit of clothes.
Yeah, all right. Well, again, hope that helps. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this morning is Kevin Waspy. He is a lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business at University of Illinois. And we do these shows once a month. He's sitting in this time around for David Sinnoh. So whatever questions you might have, I know he'll do his best to help you out. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Next up, we have someone in Charleston. This is line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I have almost quite a few questions. But first question I want to mention is that there was a caller that called in. He was in construction business for 26 years and said that it is so bad.
Yep.
And down here in Charleston, these three big home builders continue to build homes. And, you know, I don't know where the people are buying those homes because there's no jobs. And speaking of jobs, I also want to touch on jobs. And I followed the area. In fact, I've been following an area of North Texas, South Oklahoma in the past several years. I went out there and visited those areas. And out there, they had 200 to 300% growth in the available number of jobs as current to date, while this area in Charleston has lost more than 50% of available jobs that continue to go down. And also, is what I want to mention, too, is the explosion of ads in all the newspapers, including those free newspapers that, you know, publish for multiple counties. And the ads read, got scrap, get cash. And that's your scrap yard, you know, like buy aluminum, copper, and brass and all that. And I was wondering what the prices will do on those. And I was wondering what the area out there in the job market, like the South Oklahoma, North Texas area, is if whether that's a real good area to locate at, which seems to be good according to my research. It seems like they keep having a number of available jobs, and the pay is really good. And there's a lot of building material manufacturers out there. In fact, I was reading one of the newspapers last night, and they're hiring like crazy, you know, in the building materials industry that they make building materials out there. And also Halliburton Energy Service, I guess they make stuff for drilling rigs is out there. So I was wondering what your opinion would be on all these issues, you know, like the housing market, what will it take to fix it, how long will it take, the available areas in the U.S. to move, whether like North Texas, South Oklahoma would be a good area to locate to.
Well, I don't, what do you say about that? Obviously, it's a good example of something you were talking about earlier, that is, you ask what's going on with the economy, you have to say, well, okay, where are you talking about?
Right. I think, let's see, where do I begin? Economic prosperity has always been regional first and national second and global third. And what I mean is, in terms of the timing, you know, a region in this country can get hot for a particular industry, and that might grow throughout the country into other industries. We certainly saw it in the early part of this century, as that growth grew across the country and then into a global growth spurt. It's only natural that there are ebbs and flows in this growth cycle. I think we're seeing one of the slowdowns in the macro sense, in the global growth sense. We've certainly seen industry slowdowns much earlier than that within this country. And we'll probably see more pockets of weakness as things come about. I'm just not a big fan of looking at something that tends to be really cyclical and saying, that's where I'm going to make my career bet. One of the reasons I'm at the university is for that reason itself. It was a conscious decision to move into an industry that is less cyclical. Now, that said, what do you like about North Texas and what do you like about Oklahoma? You know, it's got to be more than the current day prospect of a job. If you like Lubbock, Texas for its people, for its environment, for its climate, for the opportunity to make a fair wage there, cool, move there. That's the bottom line. There's more to our lives than money. And I understand, you know, we've got to be cognizant about it. It's part of what I do. But on the other hand, it's a much more complicated decision than just where's the hottest pocket of growth right now.
All right. And other thoughts about the housing, about housing locally, or is it just, you know?
Well, again, I mean, in Charleston or any single town, whether it's in central Illinois or the Central Valley of California, you're going to see what I would call anomalies from time to time. You're going to see things that go against what might be your gut feeling. And your gut feeling is probably more true than the anomaly itself. If you don't see strong population growth in a town, in a county, in a state, why should you expect to see strong housing demand? If you don't see strong job growth, why should you not see strong population growth? Why should you not see strong demand for housing? Again, excuse me, in a longer term sense of things, if you're not seeing job growth, and it's more than just last month's downtick. If you're not seeing population growth, and it's more than just last year's census, then I agree. There shouldn't be a lot of housing activity unless there's a need to replace what I would call exhausted housing, the stuff that's just used up. Mm-hmm. That's one of the indicators that I've used that have kept me from making, how should I say, bigger mistakes in extrapolating present trends, whether it's with housing, a stock price, a commodity price, whatever.
Okay. Well, we've got some other callers here. Talk next with someone in Morton Grove on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, hi. Good morning. Mm-hmm. To stick with this theme we've stumbled into on real estate, I'd like to ask just two questions. One is, do you have an opinion as to whether this year versus next year will probably be a better time for a summer home in the state of Michigan? And secondly, is there an update on the couch-potato information? And anything you could tell me would be appreciated. Just your personal opinion, of course.
Sure. Second question first. I did bring in Dave Sinnoh's update for the couch-potato portfolio. And I believe Harriet Williamson is putting it up on the web as we speak.
I think it's actually up now.
Oh, good. It's up as we speak. So yeah. I think we're down like 11.2%, something like that. And again, that's through Tuesday this week.
Okay.
For question number two, I'll remind you that you asked me my opinion.
Yes, please.
My opinion is there's no hurry to buy a vacation house anywhere.
And is that perhaps even stronger for the state of Michigan?
You know, if either Ford or General Motors survives bankruptcy, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's devastating what's happened in that state.
Yeah, and I think the jury's still out on either one of those two companies not having to reorganize themselves through a bankruptcy.
Okay, and... Because real estate generally is local, any generalized statements about it, I guess, pretty much don't hold water.
Well, the generalized statement I would make on real estate is a very general statement, and that goes like this. Why should we expect anything to become, how should we say, an active marketplace again? And in some people's opinion, even back to the level of activity and perhaps even prices that we saw in the heyday of 2005, unless we expect a return to those conditions that drove those prices.
I see.
And that activity. Now, I'll remind you, in 2005 and 2006, it was the epitome of nonsense by the lenders that literally let people buy houses they couldn't afford and do it with none of their own money. If you want to see those conditions again, it's my belief that that's what you're going to have to wish for to expect that level of vitality to come back anytime soon into that marketplace.
Yes, and is it fair to say that second home purchases are even maybe a longer wait for comeback given their...
Well, I would certainly put second homes in the luxury category.
Okay.
And now it's just a question of who's luxury. I don't expect a big price decline for the houses in the Hamptons. But I would say that, you know, for certain areas of Michigan, unless you're vacationing with the Astors, you probably do have more decline to see. You know, the Astors aren't ever going to be hurt.
Yeah.
You know, the house in the Hamptons,
yes.
It'll always blow your mind.
Yeah.
But unless you're talking about that level of wealth, I'd have to say that luxury goods, like second houses, for vacation purposes, still haven't seen the worst levels yet.
So no hurry, then.
I'm in no hurry.
Okay. Thank you for your honesty and the information.
All right. I think that there were certainly a lot of people for a long time that made the argument that housing prices were too high. That is, the property was overvalued. It was selling. People were selling for what it truly was above what it what it should have been. So now we've had what some people would call a correction. Are we now? Is it? And I suppose when you ask how much is something worth, it's well, what's anybody willing to pay for it?
Exactly.
Okay. But having said that, now are we approaching something that's a more realistic value? Have we actually gone below? Is this correction to the point where they'll actually come back up and find what's the right sort of equilibrium, or is that point even lower than where we are?
Yeah. A long time ago, I was a trader, and one of the old guys that gave me some of the best advice said, Sonny, don't try to pick the bottom, don't try to pick the top, just pick the range. And that's really good advice. So I don't want to tell you that the prices have bottomed. I don't want to tell you that X is the bottom. I just want to tell you that the range of prices for, you know, just again, the general broad spectrum called real estate is still too high. It's still too high. Mm-hmm. There might be certain areas where, you know, X, whatever X is, has been achieved. Some of the foreclosure sales that are going on in more distressed areas that show a house that 18 months ago sold for $450,000, clear the bank auction at $150,000. You know, I mean, that might be X. Real estate is very locale dependent. So, you know, there might be too low of a price on a certain house in a certain city, but as a general investment class, as a general asset class, I still don't think the range for me is a comfortable range yet. Again, the conditions that are unfolding don't favor it. Despite all the talk we've had about actions our government has taken, whether it's the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, or all of the above, in managing interest rates lower to soften what's going on in real estate, it still costs more to borrow money on a fixed rate mortgage today than it did a year ago. The mortgage market is not totally under their control, and the cost of debt is a huge component of the value of a property.
Got about 10 minutes left here with Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business at the U of I. This is our monthly show on personal finance, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we've got some more folks here, and we'll get next to someone in Champaign. Line number two. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
If I should be so lucky as to win the lottery, what would I do with all that money? Even the Swiss banks are feeling pressured. So, you know, it's like if I win $10 million, where in the world would I put it? I mean, first I know I have to see my attorney and my tax accountant and take care of income tax and things of that sort. But with money that's left over, where in the world would I put it?
I could be flippant and answer my pocket, but I won't, and I will give you the same advice that I would give anybody, regardless of whether it's wealth that they've worked hard for their entire lives or newfound funds like winning the lotto in your example. And the bottom line is this: figure out what your objectives are and then match within your comfort level the investment asset allocation that fits those objectives. Again, each person's comfort level is their own individual choosing. Anybody can sit down and show you numbers and explain statistics, and it still has to come down to the old adage, do you want to sleep well or do you want to eat well? If you're comfortable with it and you sleep well, then it's probably a good fit for your financial objectives. Be reasonable in setting the objectives and tailor the investments in that comfort setting toward them. an asset class mix is always a best thing. So it's the old story, diversification. And the story can be, how should I say, modified by saying that with the example of winning a lottery, you've got a one-time investment opportunity as opposed to a lifetime of working, funding a retirement plan that has regular contributions. You could view the investment opportunity with a lump sum of money in a similar circumstance, though, and just say you'll funnel 1/24th of it into each asset class over the next 24 months. You don't have to make one purchase all at one time.
How much is Berkshire Hathaway selling for?
Right now?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have two classes of stock. One is approximately, I was going to say 10,000, but I'd have to quote. Let me see if I can get a quote on it.
I kind of think that that's, and is that the lower priced one? Was it just like a class A and B?
Class A or the real stock. Last traded at $117,600 a share. And the small stock, if you want to call it that, is $3,923 a share.
$3,900. Have they gone down just as the whole market has gone down?
Well, yeah, those both of those. I mean, Berkshire Hathaway has reported some earnings that have been disappointing earnings. Remember, the company predominantly is in the insurance business, and they've taken their share of write-downs on investments. They've taken their share of losses on insured properties, so on and so forth. So, yeah, the company has, fallen in price from its best level.
So they're in insurance. For some reason, I thought they were in small businesses.
Well, their biggest company is Geico.
Hmm.
You know the gecko?
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's him.
Okay. That's their biggest company.
Yes, ma'am. That's their biggest operating company.
Thank you so much for the information.
Thank you. Well, it sounds like if you had somebody who come to you who had some significant amount of money, it could be, you know, quarter of a million, half a million, you know, whatever, you would still, sounds like you would say, you would take a very conservative approach to the same kind of asset allocation if somebody had less money, and you'd say, okay, here's your asset classes. You're going to put money in stocks. Maybe you could put money in bonds. You could put money in real estate or in REITs. You maybe want to keep some money in cash. It'd be kind of like what anybody might think about doing. It's just the scale.
It's really that
different.
Excuse me. It's really that you hit the nail on the head. It's a scale factor. Unless the objectives are markedly different, I might win $1,000 in a local raffle, and literally say to myself, "This is money I'm going to take to Las Vegas and put on the pass line." You know, having the $1,000 is something I didn't have before I won the local raffle. It's not going to change my lifestyle if I didn't win the raffle. It won't change my lifestyle if I double it on the pass line. Mm-hmm. Now, barring some absurd example like that, if your objectives are common objectives most people have with the use of their money for future goals, then it's really only a scale factor, just how many zeros.
Yeah. Next, let's talk with someone in Arlington Heights, up in the Chicago area, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Oh, I love this station. I get more information from you guys than you can possibly imagine.
Just keep sending your contributions.
I'm going to do that.
Good for you.
That's good.
I just renewed my membership last week.
Unfortunately, sometimes the signal is not quite so clear up here, but it's usually a weather factor. But I do love the station. What I wanted to ask you about is I'm 65. I'm looking for fixed income stuff. And I feel like, you know, you talk about all these people that are, what's the expression, underwater on their mortgages. I feel like I'm underwater on dollars because the government, because of all this lack of regulation that got people into this horrible mess of being able to buy houses that they couldn't afford and nobody checking anybody's ability to pay anything. The bottom line for me is when I go to invest in CDs, what the bank is offering me is peanuts. The inflation, the latest figure I think I saw for this year was something in the 5% range. You add taxes on top of that. If I can only get like 1% for a year or, you know, possibly 2%, I'm losing, and it's a big rip off it. It makes me so mad I could scream. But I want to know, what can I do to invest, you know, money that I certainly can't afford to lose? I'm a retired person, but I need income. And I feel like I'm being forced into this situation to go into CDs and other extremely low-paying things because of other people's mismanagement, government mismanagement. I'm furious about the whole thing. My money has lost value. But I need to, you know, obviously I need to pay the bills, which, of course, are getting bigger all the time. What can I do with CDs? I am afraid to go out 5 years at 5% when an incoming administration, looking at the huge deficits we've got and all the things they want to spend on, I just see taxes going up and I just want to keep my head above water. Help.
Yep. Let me give you an idea, and I've done this numbers of times with different people in fixed income investment. And the strategy is a very simple strategy. We call it a ladder of maturities. And here's how it works. Take the investable sum, divide it by 5, divide it by 6, divide it by 8, 10, whatever, depending on the amount. As long as those pieces break down into investable pieces, 10,000 each, 5,000 each, 50,000 each, I don't care. Set up a ladder of maturities, meaning the money goes into 6 month, 12 month, 18 month, 24 month, 30 month, all the way out in this structure. The reason you do that is to remove you from the cycles interest rates run. Interest rates always have 3 future possibilities. They can go up, they can go down, or they can stay the same. Is that agreeable?
Yeah.
Good. Then look at that ladder and say every 6 months, 1/6, 1/8, 1/10, whatever amount of your money is now matured and available for reinvestment. And you go out and you buy the longest rung on the ladder. If you set up your ladder to run from 1 year to 3 years in 6 month increments, every 6 months you get to buy a new 3 year CD. Do 3 year CDs pay more than 6 month CDs? That's a question.
Often they do, but sometimes you're upside down when the curve's inversed.
Yep.
Like
well,
it was
I can,
a couple of years
I can,
ago.
I can count the number of times we've experienced an inverted yield curve for more than 6 months on one hand.
Hmm.
Now, I'll talk to you about a different strategy when we have an inverted yield curve, but that's off the air. But setting up a ladder of maturities is not going to get you ahead of inflation today. It's not going to get you ahead of taxes today. It is going to get you a better resolve, probably ahead of taxes, probably ahead of inflation over the long run. And that's what you're in it for.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing I'd mention about CDs is this. Banks are going to experience more problems before they experience fewer problems. What you saw in California with IndyMac is only the first, most obvious, and most flashy. Banks are hungry. So here's what you need to do. You need to remind them that you're a long-term depositor. You need to ask them to prove to you that they're financially sound, and you need to remind them that you're in it for the long run. Banks will often pay more than their, quote, stated rate on a CD if you talk with a bank officer.
Hmm.
Do your homework. Don't depend on the FDIC just to bail you out. And God forbid, don't put more than $100,000 in any bank, because your catch-all is the federal taxpayer, courtesy of the FDIC. So do your homework. Find good, sound banks that want to have a long-term relationship with your savings and pay you a slight premium above the stated rate and set up a ladder of maturities.
Hmm. Sounds like a good idea, but how do you avoid the pitfall of having more than $100,000 in a particular bank if you can find a bank that's going to go along?
If you go to the FDIC's webpage, they will show you a very simple way that a person can title different titlings of accounts to get more than a $100,000 coverage at a given financial institution. But again, if you make an investment decision, and quite honestly, I don't even consider a CD an investment. It's a savings vehicle.
Yeah.
Okay? So let's be honest. The last thing you ought to do is depend on the taxpayer to bail you out. Just because it's FDIC insured should not give you comfort.
Well, convince, especially when I know the taxpayer is me.
Convince, well, it's all of us. And
yeah.
you don't want to depend on me paying your freight because I'm not going to do it.
Well, we're paying
I'm
going
to leave.
On
I'm
going to
go to Australia.
Stuff.
I'm not going to pay your freight.
Mm-hmm.
But find a good, solid bank. Have them convince you of their financial soundness. Set up a ladder of maturities. Deal with them on a long-term customer basis.
I need to jump in here because we're very close to the end of the time. One real small point here. I want to make sure I get solid in my mind and for other people. For the FDIC insurance, that amount, $150,000. Now,
$100,000.
$100,000. Now, does that mean, is that per account or is that the total amount of money that you have in a given bank?
That is per titling. There are different accepted titlings that are considered to be different ownership account arrangements.
Okay.
Each ownership titling is $100,000 per bank.
Okay.
Again, the FDIC.gov web page will show people very quickly, very easily. I believe two people can structure account titlings to come up with something like $700,000 coverage in any single bank. But again, deal with a reputable, good, sound financial institution.
All right. There we got to leave it. My apologies. We have a couple of people that we cannot take. We'll do it again next month. Our guest, Kevin Wasby, is lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business at the U of I. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. It's been fun.